Okay, hi there. Yes? No? Maybe? Sure. Thank you. Okay. How are we? You're all fine? Good? You can't hear me? Yes, you can. Okay, you can hear me. I can hear you. You should hear me. All right. I apologize again for not bringing a stapler. Talia, make a note. Next time we have something due, bring a stapler. But if your name is on everything, even if Talia shuffles it, she can put it back together, which is why she won't shuffle it. I'm trying to evolve into a person with a stapler that grows inside the first molar so I can put the paper in on the buckle side, and thought I'd never be able to use that word in a sentence. There we go. Right over there. No, right there. Right there. Sorry about that, Talia. But just remember, one third is the answers, the answer sheets. The rest we have to read. Okay. Information. Exam 2. Monday, week from today. Here. Unless your last name begins with A through F, in which case you will take it in VOTI 105. Okay? Everybody else will be here. Bring a number 2 pencil. Okay, study skills sessions. We promised, Talia offered to talk about studying this kind of material and preparing for the exams. The first of those is after class at 5 in Living Learning Commons 315, above the Marché, 2 floors above the Marché, and Wednesday at 2 in 216 Commons Living Learning. Okay? Those are her regular office hours, so be aware that if you're planning to go to her office hours, she won't be there because she'll be doing the study sessions. We tried to get her to have an identical twin, but it didn't work. So we can only afford one of her anyway. And review sessions. Wednesday, this week after class, in Fleming 101. Thursday at 5 here, and Sunday at 5 in Living Learning Commons 315 again. Just a word of caution on that. I have not yet received confirmation on that space at that time, but I will tomorrow. If that's not right, I'll send an email correction and correct it on the website. Okay? Questions? Would I go back up to the study skills? Yes. Okay. This is on the website. That's what I'm showing, so you can check it. People are really taking me literally that it's due at the beginning of class. Right? Thank you. Not that you don't always take me seriously, but even when you shouldn't, you do. Which is why I have to be really careful with my sense of humor. All right. No housekeeping questions. We're all okay. Format for the exam on Monday will be the same, except the topic will be cognitive development. The difference is that this time there may be questions that ask you to connect cognitive development to biological development. There won't be any questions that are just about biological development. They'll all be either on cognitive development or on the connection between the two. I hope you're not seeing this overhead in your sleep yet, but I hope that you can reproduce it in your sleep and that you understand what it means. So I'm going to put it up again. We looked at three different types of problems last week, and we're going to look at the fourth one today, and then I'll do a couple of other demonstrations. And just to reiterate, what I'm trying to have you take home with you and bring back with you is that when we're looking at cognitive development, I'm particularly enamored of Piaget's approach in this simplified version, which is that we start with our sensory motor experience in the world. We develop schemas or reproducible patterns based on that experience, and we extend those patterns, we make them longer, and we connect them to each other, and they become the basis for our knowledge. As we develop, we add the ability to represent many of those schemas in a number of different ways, one of which is in words. We develop language as a way of representing our understanding, and words refer to specific experiences or patterns that we have experienced in the sensory motor mode, and grammar represents the rules for connecting schemas that those words refer to. So there's a connection between the grammar in language or in any of our other representations, and the logic or the consistency or the reality that we've experienced in the real world through our sensory motor skills. As we move up into the elementary school years, we go through another shift that represents the organization of those schemas and the rules for putting them together into logical categories and connections that we begin to be able to reason about so that we can begin to see when things are not logical. But during the elementary school years, before we get up into adolescence, most of us are restricted to thinking about things that we actually have experience with. We have a sensory motor representation for those things. As we move into adolescence, we add what is for Piaget the fourth layer in our knowledge, which is the ability to think about the relationships among relationships or abstract systems of connection among those schemas. The schemas are still in some way connected to our sensory motor experience, but they have gotten very large, they've gotten very systematic, and we've begun to be able to think about their relationships in an abstract way. That is, we don't have to think about how they're literally connected in our physical world, but we can think about the shape or the form of the systems of relationships that we're dealing with. And that leads us to, after we consolidate those operations that he called formal operations, that leads us to be adult thinkers. And from his perspective, and I happen to agree with him, you don't have to, but I do, there isn't anything more complex than that. What happens after that is the way we use the formal operational skills that we have. We develop expertise based on long experience, we develop wisdom, and some of the authors that textbooks describe are talking about how we make sense out of the whole world, but the knowledge that we use is still organized in Piaget's thinking and in mine, I realize that puts me, I'm trying to put myself in his class. The only way Piaget and I are similar is that his office was even messier than mine. Okay. So that's why mine is messy. I'm aspiring to be like Piaget. But from his perspective, and I agree with him, the logic that we use, the formal operational logic, is as sophisticated as it gets. We just get more experience with it, more experiences to organize and to reflect on as we're applying our formal operational logic. The notion of being formal is based on looking at the shape or the form of the connections, the systems that we're thinking about, and being able to compare them, and those are abstract forms. And that, I suggested, leads us to the important notion of isomorphism, or having the same shape. Isomorphism is important at all stages in our thinking. We can look at sensory motor experiences and see that they are the same experience. We're having it in two different places, two different times. We can, as children, see that two things are quite similar to each other, so we group them together. We use words to do that. We base our classes and categorizations in the elementary school years on the similarities. What is different about adolescence is that we can do the abstract thinking about whether or not things are really following the same very complex or abstract pattern. The examples that we looked at, I asserted, are examples where you're looking for and discovering a pattern and finding it, applying it over and over again. So that applies to the analogy task, the verbal analogies, where we're looking at a relationship between two of the words and then finding one that has the same form. But because it's a relationship that we've generated and we have to compare it in our heads, it's an abstract comparison. And kids don't do well, people don't do well on verbal analogies until they get into adolescence. When we looked at the number series, the number of relationships, again, we were looking at a series of relationships that are the same, in this case, squaring or multiplying a number by itself. The numbers are different, so the content varies, but the form is the same. And we solve the problem by applying that form or that relationship to an example, and we make it consistent with the others, so it has the same form, the same shape. And then the others we illustrated look at putting together different series or combinations of relationships, so those problems become more complex. But again, it's putting the same or a constantly changing form into the context of the numbers so that we come up with a consistent series. And then we had fun with the proverbs by looking for the sentence, X, Y, or Z, that had the same meaning or abstract form, meaning, same set of relationships that the proverb had. And that allowed us to recognize how motivated we can be to try to find isomorphism and how disequilibrating or how producing of disequilibrium it is if we can't make them match. So the search for sameness, isomorphism, is constant for all of those problems. And I left you with the thought that adolescents become able to see when two things are not isomorphic. And when they're supposed to be isomorphic, the disequilibrium causes adolescents to get upset enough to criticize their elders, to have arguments with their teachers, with their parents, and it makes them adult thinkers. They argue with each other about what things mean and whether they're consistent and whether we are being logical enough. And the word that I applied as an example of that is hypocritical. And we call somebody hypocritical when they are not being logical enough. Not enough logic, critique. But when you're supposed to be consistent and you're not, when you have a double standard, when you say one thing and do something different, we call you hypocritical. And the adolescent begins to understand what that means, because their logic allows them to find the non-isomorphism in the world around them. Let me give you an example. No, let's go on to the fourth problem and then I'll give you other examples. Okay, this problem, the combinations and permutations, is designed to illustrate two or three characteristics of adolescent thinking. And the first of those is that adolescents begin to expect that there will be a system of systematic relationships among items in a problem. And this one specifically says, okay, we've got coins. We know that there's a consistent relationships among the coins. We've learned that as children. We've learned to add and subtract, to make change, to hoard our to hoard our pennies, and to accuse our little brothers and sisters of stealing money out of our piggy bank if there's not a consistency between what we thought we had and what we find. So you approach this expecting that there would be an answer, and there is. This one is not a trick. There is an answer. So here you are. How many different sums, excluding zero, can be made with this set of coins? Two pennies, a nickel, two dimes, and a quarter. What did you get? 33? That's a pretty good answer. Who got something different? Loud. 32. Anybody get the right answer? 24? 18? 11? 36? 1? 34? How many? 720? 720. Okay. 35. 35, okay. 38. They're coming out of the woodwork now. You've got the idea that there's some disagreement about this, right? So now it's okay, because most of you thought that the first answer out would be the right answer, and obviously it wasn't yours. So you assume that yours is wrong because somebody must know. And now a little disequilibrium here. There's certainly some disagreement. How many of you actually pulled out coins and went through the addition and summed them up? None of you? Good. Oh, you did. I'm sorry. Well, it's all right that you did too. Sorry. I should have looked before I said good. Okay. No, it's okay that you did. Why did you do that? She's visual? Good. Okay. The fact that most of you didn't means that you had some way of representing the coins that didn't require you to actually have them. When I do this problem with elementary school kids, the first thing they have to have is a set of the coins, because they don't have consistent ways to represent, and a person who is more visual is assisted by having that set of coins to connect the numbers to. Okay, how many of you made some kind of chart? Okay. That's also an adolescent phenomenon. People assume there is some consistent way to keep track. How many of you thought you could keep track of all the different sums in your head and didn't make a chart? And did you?
No.
No, okay. Why not? It's too complex. The text talks about metacognition. Metacognition is our understanding of our own thinking, the kind of theory of mind that we have. And metacognition, which takes a big jump in adolescence as we get more able to look at the limitations of our own minds and the size of the potential amount of data that we have for a particular problem, tells us, in most cases, I need to keep track of this, and I can't keep those numbers in my head. There are going to be too many of them, and it's going to overwhelm my ability to represent them in my head. So we make a list, we make a chart, we make some kind of way to keep track of the sums that we're getting. We expect that of adolescents, that they will begin to do that. Not everybody does, but what you find out pretty quickly, if you don't, is you get overwhelmed with data and can't remember where you started. The problem elementary school kids have with this kind of problem is that it doesn't even occur to them to keep track. They're just going to keep track in their head, and after a while they've forgotten completely where they are. They're lost. And I'll give you a couple of other examples of problems where that happens with children. Even if you give them paper and pencil, they don't use them, because they don't understand, as they go into the problem, what is likely to be generated by doing this problem. They assume they can keep track. They can't. They're lost. So metacognition is the understanding of how big this problem is likely to get. Okay. How did you get 720? Anybody remember factorials? Right. Is that what you used? 5 times 4 times 3 times 2 times 1, because you have 6 coins. Right. And so what did you get? 720 what's? Permutations. So you were actually misled by the inaccurate labeling of this problem as being a permutation problem. How many of you thought you ought to be using factorials but don't remember them at all? How many of you studied them? Let's get this. Remember factorials, right? You learned these. How many of you actually studied them? How many of you could actually do a factorial problem using permutations, a permutation problem using factorials today, based on what you remember? No, even with paper. Okay, so 95% of you studied factorials and you don't have a clue what they were. Now, you just know that sometimes when you're supposed to put together a list of all the possible combinations, which is what permutations means, you use factorials. And how many of you remember that there were two different factorial formulas? One for ordered combinations and one for unordered combinations. Which gives you 720? Ordered or unordered? I don't know either. If, whatever you had said, I was going to say that's right. I don't have a clue. Okay. The problem with the problem is it's not a factorial problem. Because it's not about how many different ways you can arrange them, it's about how many sums you can make. What's the maximum number that you could make? What's the biggest number of sums there could possibly be, no matter how you organize the data? 52. Okay? Right? I used this problem for about 15 years before a wonderful UVM female engineering student got the answer like that, and I said, how did you do that? She said, it's a min-max problem. Right? Do I know min-max? No. The biggest sum would be 52, the smallest would be 1, I've eliminated 0. So 1 to 52, just write them out, and then eliminate every number that ends in 3, 4, 8, or 9, because you only have 2 pennies. To make any number that ends in 3, you need 3 pennies, and you don't have them. So you just go through 1 to 52 and cross out everything like 3, 13, 23, 33, 43, and the 8s and the 9s, everything else you can make. Some of them you can make multiple ways, and you end up with some number like 32. Okay, I'll believe you. Okay, so what have we illustrated? Metacognition, that adolescents sometimes begin to understand that they're going to have to keep track. 2, the notion of permutations, all the possible combinations, but then thinking about what the problem really asks for, which is not all the permutations, it's all the sums, and that's a different problem. So we have to figure out a different way to do it. 3, some kind of systematic approach. 1 to 52 and eliminating the ones you can't make is real clever. And why is that answer wrong, those of you who got something else? How many of you remember set theory? How many of you studied set theory? Okay, I'm not gonna embarrass you. Just how many of you actually studied set theory? If you studied factorials, you probably got to set theory. You don't even remember whether you did or not. Okay. You know your math teachers are rolling over. Wherever they are, they're rolling over. Say, we spent 6 weeks on set theory. They didn't understand it then. Now they don't even remember that they didn't understand it. Freud would have something to say about forgetting. So, what's the problem? If you have studied set theory, the problem says you're going to make a sum with the following set of coins, and in set theory, you have to use them all. You can't leave any out because it's a set. You can't subdivide it because it doesn't say you can. In set theory, you can subdivide, but you have to specify that. And if you don't, then everybody is included. And the answer is 1. And the only sum you can make is 52 because you have to add up all of those coins. Now, aren't you sorry you didn't remember set theory? Okay, so that's one right answer. 1. But it depends on understanding set theory. What's another right answer? How many of you took the word sum seriously? No, okay. Where's math teaching going? Or why do people who understand math not take human development? I know, you know about sums, but you're afraid now to raise your hand because you figure, okay. So a sum is made by adding two things together. So any of the amounts that you can make only with one coin, like 1 and 5, aren't permissible because they're not sums, they're just amounts. And there's, if you're a mathematician, there's a technical difference between the amount and the sums. The sums have to be the result of adding two or more things together because that's what sum means. Is this getting frustrating? Yeah, well, good. I think that's all there is. I think that's all there is. But what that does is leave you with the possibility of at least 3 correct answers, and probably 4, depending on whether you are looking at the word set in its technical sense, the word sum in its technical sense, or both of those in their technical sense, or taking it as a layman, saying, okay, how many different amounts can I make with this set of coins, not taking set formally, and you get something like 32, 34, I don't know, I forgot. Okay, what does that illustrate? The right answer depends on what you think the problem is. And what you think the problem is depends on your understanding of arithmetic and mathematics. So like a good economist, the answer you get depends on the assumptions that you make. Your system of numbers that you apply to get the answer to this problem is variable. You can make different assumptions about how those numbers are related to each other. If you know set theory, then you have one set of assumptions. If you know the technical definition of sum, you have a different set of assumptions. And let me tell you where I've been with this problem over the last 35 years. This problem was a snap and really simple the first 10 years I used it. And everybody believed me that there was something like 33 or 34. And then people started questioning it. And I have learned more about math by having people teach me in this class or adolescent development about how to do this problem because they bring in their own assumptions. And I'm perfectly happy, and I hope you are too, with the fact that there are different right answers depending on what you know about math. Is that okay? There are different right answers depending on what you know about math. Is that all right? It's all right because you're adolescents or above, you're adults. Yeah, okay, that makes sense. Sure, right, fine. Try that in a fifth grade. Try giving a problem that has 3 or 4 right answers depending on the assumptions you make. Students will go home and they will tell you that their teacher is the dumbest teacher they've ever had. She gave a test. It's always a she when I talk about it. The teacher gave a test that had more than one right answer. This is not the way the world works. This is not logical using concrete operations. Elementary school age kids need a right answer, and that's what concrete operational thinking gives you, a right answer. And to have them think that the right answer might depend on the way the numbers are related to each other is totally, absolutely absurd and contrary to reality, because that's not the way numbers are. And one of the things that happens as we get into adolescence and become formal operational is that we can accept that systems may change depending on what assumptions we make. And the assumptions are very important. But only adolescents know about assumptions. Children don't know about assumptions. Adolescents do, because assumptions become very important. What are you assuming about reality or about your parents or about the world or about next summer? Because that will change how you think about whatever the subject is. That's an adult thought. that adolescents begin to be able to have. Okay, let me illustrate a couple of other things. Here's a problem that Piaget used. I love this problem. I've done it with kids from about 6 up. I could do it with infants up, and I'll ask you to tell me how infants and toddlers think about this problem. Here's the problem. You didn't like math? How many of you love chemistry? Right, all right, good. We're in good shape. Yeah. Because if we don't have at least 2 people who love chemistry, this doesn't work. All right. I have on this table in front of me 4 beakers. And each beaker is nearly full to the top with a clear chemical, fluid, liquid. Okay. They all look the same from where you're sitting. They look the same from here. I'm not going to let you smell them or taste them. So here they are. Beside these 4 beakers, which are labeled using scientific notation. The scientific notation is 1, 2, 3, and 4. Beside them is a little eyedropper bottle with an eyedropper in it. And it's also labeled G for G. I wonder what's in there. It's also a clear liquid. And this table is full of empty test tubes and racks and paper and pen to write on. And out of my back pocket, I'm going to take a test tube. And this test tube also has a clear liquid in it. And I'm going to tell you that this clear liquid came from these 4 beakers. And I'm going to take the dropper of G, and I'm going to put 3 drops in the test tube and shake it a little bit, and the clear liquid is going to turn bright orange. Neat. And I'm going to put that there so you can look at it. Now, your task is to figure out how to make that bright orange again. Go for it. What are you going to do? One at a time, you will come down. Here are the beakers. You can pour stuff. Beakers, here are the test tubes. Pour stuff. Just do it. What are you going to do when you get down here? Yeah? Exactly. Now you have the structure of the problem. So what's your first step going to be? Okay, you're down here. Now go for it. Okay, help him out. He's down here. He needs help. Okay, the ratio doesn't matter. They're all molar quantities. Okay, how are you going to do that? Trial and error. That's good, since that's all you got. So what are you going to trial?
You said that it came from one beaker.
No, I said it came from these beakers.
From the combination. So you try different combinations, and then you have to see how you replicate the
water. Okay, which one do you want to try first?
Just one at a time. And
then one at a time? Okay. So you want to do them in any order? One? Somebody wants to do one? That didn't work. No. They do not. I'll give you that. They do not. But you can find that out by trial and error anyway. Probably.
Can you take 4 test tubes and the 4 beakers, put liquid in each of them, and 2 drops in each of the tube, and whatever turns orange?
Okay, so somebody did 1. You want to do 2, and then you want to do 3, and then you want to do 4. Yeah, okay. What are you going to put in the first test tube?
1.
Okay, that didn't work.
2.
2, that didn't work.
3.
3, that didn't work.
4.
That didn't work. Would you like to make a chart? Okay. Okay. Then what? Oh my goodness. It turned orange. What? You did it. 1 and 3 plus G.
Could you just have worked backwards and taken your fire and boil it down and see what?
You don't have a Bunsen burner. Yeah. Sorry. No centrifuge. I've described everything you've got is right here. So no, I said it was from these beakers. That's a very ambiguous statement. Okay, but now you've discovered how to do it. You mix 1 and 3, add some G. There you go. Happy? You want to do, are there others? No. What do you want to do? We're making a chart. What do you want to do? 1 and 4. Two and three, 2 and 4. 3 and 4.
All 4 together.
You're on a roll. Go for it. Okay. Somebody said all 4 together. Uh-huh. What are you doing? 1, 2, 3. Ah! You were right. There was another way to do it. And 1, 2, 4. 2, 3, 4. 1, 3, 4. We got them all? All the possible combinations? Unordered? Factorial. 4 times 3 times 2 times 1? No. 3 times 2 times... I don't know. One of those. Oh, you got to divide it by something. Okay, so you have 2 ways to make the orange. Now, what do you know about chemical number 1?
It reacts with 3
and with the G. So, 1 is... One is there, it's active, reactive, interactive, transactive. What do you know about the orange color? You have to have both 1 and 3.
But you can't have 4.
But you can't have 4. So what do you know about 2? Neutral? Doesn't seem to have an effect. And what do you know about 4? It inhibits? How do you know that? Because if 4 is present, it doesn't happen. Do you like the word inhibit? You don't like inhibitions, I know. Okay. Anything else you could tell me about 4? There's a hypothesis brewing out there. I can feel it. You really want to see if it inhibits? What's the other side of inhibiting? Red? Reacting?
Activating?
Eh?
Activating.
Now, you're saying that 4 is inhibiting. What else might it do? If I put 4 in here, what's going to happen? It's going to turn clear. Think so? Yes, it does. Add 4 to this, which has already turned orange, and it reverses the reaction. Same thing here. Okay? Love it. Okay, so what you just demonstrated is what the text refers to as hypothetico-deductive logic. Which is what Piaget says you begin to develop in adolescence, using formal operations, being able to construct systematic relationships, and having constructed a system of relationships, being able to develop hypotheses which you can then test, and having tested them, you can draw deductions about the relationships within the system that you have constructed. And it's important to note the hyphen in here, because what distinguishes adolescent and adult thought is the ability to think about your hypotheses logically and to test your hypotheses logically. So on the exam, don't tell me that only adolescents can develop hypotheses. Infants develop hypotheses. Children develop hypotheses. Imaginary friends are hypothetical. The difference is that adolescents can generate the hypotheses and then think about them logically. Something else is illustrated in this task. Okay, you developed hypotheses. Also, you applied, one of you applied, the notion that this was a metacognition problem and you needed to make a chart. Thank you! And the second thing that you started with is there is a set of all the possible combinations, and having found one way to make the orange color, knowing that there were other combinations that were possible within this system, you wanted to test them. Okay? Yes, adolescents do that. Adolescents aren't happy with just one way of doing things. They want to find the other ways of doing things. So if you're the high school math teacher who insists that there is only one way to do this kind of problem, the smart adolescents will tear you apart. They won't believe that. And they will dislike you immensely if you don't let them explore the other ways you might do this problem, but you insist yours is the right way. Theirs can't possibly be as good as yours. You build up a power struggle with adolescents who are thinking as good as you or better than you are. And adolescents want to play with all the possible combinations. All the possibilities, all the hypothetical possibilities. Now, in the next unit, we're going to come back to that notion when we talk about personality and psychological development, social development, because we're going to look at Piaget and the notion of identity and why adolescents have so much difficulty with the question of, who am I? Because adolescents, looking into the future, can see all kinds of possible futures. And they can play those futures out. They can look at, they can think about the hypothetical possibilities, and they begin to understand that there's an infinite number of lives they could live. And that makes it difficult to know which one you're going to live and what kind of sense of identity you're going to have while you do that. So this is not just abstract stuff that doesn't have an application in real life. Some of you are struggling with your majors because you know there are other majors and you want the one that fits. Where's the isomorphism for you between major in college and your identity? Which ones fits you? And some of you are discovering non-isomorphism between your skills and what your major requires. Right? It's called organic chem. The major requires it. You don't have a clue. Human development beckons. It's one of the hypothetical possibilities. Okay, what else does this demonstrate? Hypothetical. Hypothetical. Contrary to fact or completely abstract. How many of you would be willing to bet that the four would reverse the orange in this one, having reversed the orange in this one? How many of you would bet? Okay, you're pretty sure of yourselves, right? It would. Now, you're willing to make a bet. We'll put a limit on it. $500. I hold the money. You're willing to make a bet on a set of numbers on the board, a couple of which have circles around them. You have just demonstrated hypothetical deductive reasoning on a problem that has no representation in front of you except my words and what I've told you. Look at the table. You see beakers? Test tubes? Orange? The entire problem, as you have done it, and done it quite well, the entire problem is hypothetical. You have taken the answers I gave and reasoned about them, and if I had told you that this one turned orange, but this one didn't, you're going to start questioning either your knowledge of chemistry or mine, because that would be illogical in this system. It would be illogical. It wouldn't be consistent. So you are able to think about the consistent relationships within this system of relationships that I have constructed using my words and the numbers on the board. So you have thought this problem through and are willing to make a 50-cent bet. And you're just taking my word for it. No beakers, no fluids, no test tubes, no orange color. The entire problem is hypothetical. What happens if I try to do this with a group of fourth graders? Hey, Mom, we had this really neat guy came to school, crazy as a bed bug. He started talking about stuff that wasn't there and expected us to answer questions about it. Man, I don't know how he got in the school, but they said he was a professor. I want to go to college and find people like him. Talk about a fantasy life, you know. All right, so it's a completely hypothetical problem, and you thought about it in a systematic and logical way, which elementary school kids cannot do. They must have the concrete stuff. When elementary school kids have the concrete stuff, they can approach this problem reasonably well, though they rarely get all of the answers. So what happens? Any of the problems that Piaget uses and any task that you can think of, kids will approach differently. Infants and toddlers would have a ball with this. I'd have to put it on the floor instead of on the table because they can't see it on the table. What would they do with the test tubes and beakers and the fluids? They would indeed. And none of what I was using was particularly toxic, but I wouldn't want them to drink it. Okay. So toddlers would have a sensory motor experience. They would apply their sensory motor skills to rearranging my equipment. And they would mix the chemicals. They'd have a lot of fun doing that. It would be lots of fun. Kids with words, the 3 and 4 year olds, would watch the demonstration and they would ask me questions about what these are and what those are and how do you do that. And we'd have a conversation and then they would start mixing stuff and pouring because they have pretty good skills and they would pour, but they would have no language for what they were doing and it wouldn't be systematic. I've only gone down to 4 year olds with this. And it was fun. The kids had a great time doing chemistry, is what they were doing. I told them it was my chem set. Elementary school kids add the ability to be logical about this, and they come at it. They can do this problem, no problem at all. They come at it, and they take some 1, and then they take some 2, and then they take some 3, and then they take some 4. And then they draw a conclusion, which is that what I pulled out of my back pocket, or with them I do from under the cabinet, was different. It couldn't have been from these beakers because they tried all of them and it didn't turn orange. So their schemas are limited to 1 at a time until they get a little bit older and they've had more experience. Then they say, oh, and they can do this if you scaffold it for them, if you kind of structure it. Well, what else could you do with the chemicals? And they'll say, oh, I could mix them. Okay. And then they typically start, they do 1 and 2, and that didn't work. And then they do 3 and 4, and that didn't work. And they say, well, you tricked us. I tried them all, and they didn't work. What they don't have is the systematic combinations. You can lead them from that as they get a little bit older, so they will do the systematic combinations, but they won't go to 3. You almost did that. And then they'll go to 3 or 4. They usually jump over 3 to mix all 4 and then come back to 3. But by this time, they are totally confused about what they've done because even though they have the paper, they have the pencil, I have said there's paper and pencil to write on if you need it, knowing full well they need it, their science teachers are rolling over. These are 4th graders now, sometimes 5th graders, who aren't writing it down. They have spent 4 years of science education where the big deal is recording your observations. And they do that in science class, and then they get to my lab, and it's gone. Even though I've said we're going to do science. Gone. They don't record anything. And then they totally lose track of what they've done. If they accidentally do get the orange color, then we can start talking about, it doesn't occur to them that there is another possible way to do it unless I prompt them, and as they get a little bit older, they'll begin to put that together. So what you see and what Piaget describes in the book in which he presents this is from the beginning of concrete operations at 5 or 6 up through middle adolescence, you see steady progress in the ability to put together this set of systematic relationships and reason about them. But the kids don't get there to the place where you are until they get at least up into middle adolescence. Then they can deal with, here's a whole abstract system of relationships that I can keep in mind if I record some things. And I can think about them. And that's scientific reasoning. And it's fun. Okay. Let me illustrate a very nice, complex kind of isomorphism. When I had read this problem and I had wanted to do it when I got to the University of Pittsburgh in my first job. I wanted to, with a graduate student, go out and do this chemical combinations problem with a bunch of children of different ages and see what I found. And I, fortunately, psychology at Pitt is in a big building full of the natural sciences. psychology there is monkey brains and eyeballs, and it's part of the natural sciences. I don't know why, but around the corner and downstairs was the chemistry department. So I went down to a chemist and said, here's what I want to do. Can I steal the chemicals out of your supply lab? He looked at the description of the chemicals that Piaget had used, and he looked at it and he said, yeah, that'll work, but the color's not going to be very vivid. Piaget describes it as yellow. That's all I knew. He looks at it, just reads it, says it's not going to be very vivid. You're going to be working with kids. Do you want something a little more powy? Sure. He said, okay, let me see what I can fix up. He goes to his supply lab. He pulls out 4 or 5 chemicals. He puts them together. I mean, he puts them on a table. He mixes them the way I need them. And he says, there, that'll be much brighter. It'll be much more effective with the kids. It'll really impress them. And it is. It's a nice bright orange, and it happens very quickly. And when you put in the G, it disappears very quickly. The way Piaget had done it, it's actually a slow, the yellow kind of emerges, and put the G in it, or the four, I missed that up. It slowly fades. But what he gave me was pizzazz. He knew that. He didn't even have to do it to know what the reaction was going to look like. He was a chemist, professor of chemistry. He knew that Piaget's combination would be slow and anemic, and he knew that I didn't want that. So what he did was take the set of relationships that Piaget had represented by using the 5 chemicals that he did, and he took a different set of chemicals, only one of which was the same, so there are 4 new chemicals and 1 holdover, and he preserved the same set of relationships among them to have the same effect by applying his knowledge of what all those chemical reactions were. Piaget didn't even attempt to describe what the chemical reaction was. He just said, this is what you do. 1, 2, 3, 4, and G, this is what they are. They need to be molar saturated. And what the chemist did was say, okay, here's a set. I'm going to duplicate that system of relationships with a different set of chemicals. And it won't be quite the same. It'll be different in the way you want it to be different. Color. Okay. So he created an isomorphic system with just that one difference. That's pretty impressive. You can do the same thing. Let me show you. Okay, remember this set of relationships. Let's see if I can create something that's isomorphic. Let's see if, using my notes, I can create something isomorphic. Sure I can. Okay. Alice. We know about Alice. Okay. Judy. Fred. And Planned Parenthood of Northern New England. Okay, now these are not quite the same, but this is a person, a person, a person, and a professional, or 2 or 3 or 4. Okay. Now, In my system, there is a G, and it's sex. Maybe it's the G spot. Okay. I'm going to number these. And Alice and Judy are going to have sex together. Okay? So we know something about them. And they have a great time. It's okay. Do that. And Alice and Fred have sex together. And if they do that often enough, sometimes the little test that they use comes out not orange but pink, and they have a pregnancy. If Alice goes to Planned Parenthood of Northern New England, I'm not sure they can have sex. They probably should not. But there certainly isn't a pregnancy then. And if Judy and Fred have sex over a period of time, they don't get pregnant. And if Judy and Planned Parenthood get together, which they really shouldn't, and if Fred and Planned Parenthood, okay, no pregnancy. Have I got all of them? But if Alice and Judy and Fred have sex, and now we know something else about them, occasionally a pregnancy occurs. But if Alice and Fred use the services of Planned Parenthood of Northern New England, then there is no pregnancy. What am I missing? 2, 3, 4. Okay. So what do we know about Alice? Eh? Okay. Right. And she's bisexual. Okay. She's fertile and bisexual. She is involved whenever there's a pregnancy. Okay. What do we know about Judy? Infertile, assuming that the pregnancy appears in Alice's body, which we will assume. Okay, so there is no, it's not in Fred's, we know that. Okay, so we know that Judy is also bisexual, but perhaps infertile. What do we know about Fred? Right, you don't want to be dating him. And he is fertile. What do we know about Planned Parenthood of Northern New England? When they're involved with contraceptive services, no pregnancy. What would happen if we added Planned Parenthood of Northern New England to this situation? What? I know, it's a
No baby.
Because among their services is pregnancy termination. Okay. Are those systems reasonably isomorphic? Is it the same set of relationships? There's chemistry involved, right? Of all sorts. Is that the same set of relationships that we saw in the chemicals? No? How not? Okay, so the content is different. This is people, this is sex, this is pregnancies, the other was a set of fluids. Well, there's fluids. Okay, there are all kinds of possible isomorphisms here in the content, but I think the set of relationships is reasonably similar. But there's a significant difference. And that is that these three are not the same as this, which is an organization or a professional not involved in the sexuality that is part of what else is going on. So there's a non-isomorphism here. What you will be asked to do in life and often in courses is something that begins to be more regular as you become formal operational in your reasoning, which is that you will be asked to compare abstract systems to see to what extent they are similar, to compare them, and to what extent and in what ways they are dissimilar, or to contrast them. So what we see in formal operational reasoning in adolescence and in college and in graduate school particularly is an increased use and expectation that you will be able to compare and contrast abstract systems of thought or analysis. Two different theories to explain the same behavior. For example, in psychology, I might ask you, here's a situation, tell me how Erickson would explain it, and then tell me how Bandura would explain it, and how those two approaches are similar and different. They give you different interpretations. Where are they similar? Where are they different? That means you have to know Erickson's system, you have to know Bandura's system, and you have to be able to think about where they are the same and where they are different. You are expected to do that as an adult. And college is a lot of opportunity to experience that. In this course, you're learning about biological development across the lifespan, cognitive development across the lifespan. I said we'll connect them, but you can also expect to be asked, how is biological development similar and how is it different from cognitive development? We know they're related, but how are they similar? How are they different? What are the isomorphisms between them? And what are the non-isomorphisms? And you're able to do that kind of thinking because you have the complex schemas that let you do that. And you develop those schemas as you study the various systems of thinking. See you Wednesday.